Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Renan Devayer. Renan is the founder and CEO of OSS Ventures. Renan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Christian.
Oh, my pleasure. So let's start with OSS. I'd love to know the firm's investment thesis.
Sure. So we build and invest only in technological companies that are pivoting our production model. So basically the factories, the trucks, the supply chain, the warehouse, all the things. And we build and invest, meaning that you can be a builder, you don't have an idea, but you want to launch a company in the space, we'll help you set up, or you already have a company going on, very early stage. We usually invest when the founders have a Gmail account. And we write you a check and we get you going.
Fantastic. So once you identify an investor, you believe there's promise with their product, what's the degree that OSS gets involved with bringing the product to market?
Yep. So we have 20 people in the investment fund, of which 18 are operational. So I literally have coders, designers, and marketers on the payroll. And typically, our companies get 40 to 60% of their first million revenue from our introductions because we run a network of 2,200 factories and warehouse and operational sites that have already used at least one OSS portfolio solution. And usually they like it. So we can call them back and say, hey, you had that startup solving that great problem that you had. There is another one. We believe in its potential. Do you want to take the call?
Fantastic. And what are some examples of products or solutions that OSS has brought to market over the last few years?
Yeah, sure. So the oldest one is called Fabric. It's a 150 company, people company now. So it's like a big company. But what they do is they digitize and they enhance with AI the lean process that is in factory. So in factories, usually you have a daily brief meeting where you will talk about your programs, the KPI, the action plan that you are setting up. If there's a quality issue, you start solving the issue and everything. And so Fabric helps streamline that. And with AI, it also helps proactively look for potential issues rather than just reacting. And so they are live in like 600 factories now. And the very first client that Fabric signed was the two founders and I working on the shop floor of an aerotics company 4.5 years ago. So pretty hands-on, if you ask me.
You just read my mind. I was literally about to say hands-on. And so great sense. And how often will you get involved with creating prototypes or actual physical products as well?
So we have 22 portfolio companies, 19 of which are software. So we mostly do software. We also dive into hardware-backed software. So basically, you need the hardware to do a software solution. So yep. Sensors on the machines kind of situation. I would say 75% of the companies we created, Google created with founders, we were actually there for the first ideation with the founders.
Great. And then as far as geography, do you find that you're predominantly working with founders in Europe or are you working?
So 40% in Europe, 40% in the US, and 20% rest of the world. So we are very geography agnostic. We tend to have a footprint that is the West because the factories in the West, the warehouse in the West have a very similar set of issues. But then the factories in China, the factories in China, in India, they have a very different set of problems because the labor cost is not the same. So when the labor cost is not the same, like if you have an issue, you just throw more bodies. And you can do that in the US.
Interesting. Okay, that makes great sense. What was the genesis behind starting OSI.
So it's funny. I had sold my startup in San Francisco. So I made some money in the craziness that is the startup world in San Francisco. And so I was kind of retired at like 29, something like that, 30. And I visited Tesla Fremont. And before that, I had worked like 10 years in manufacturing. So I had seen like hundreds of factories. And I got blown away. Like, I told myself, okay, I'm literally seeing what factories will be in 20 years with 20 years advance. And so basically you have coders running around with Apple laptops and they are coding the machines and they are solving the things with data and the factory is pristine. And it's very different from your typical factory. And people are well paid. Like the richest man in the world created the car company and the first factory was in California, where the cost of labor is like crazy high. And so it means that if you do it right with technology, with data, with AI, you can have factories that are as fun to operate as a tech company because they are tech enabled. And so I got that thrown into my face. And I said, okay, I'm going to reuse like 2/3 of the money I made from my previous exits. I'm going to invest it in trying to get that same thing going on in all factories in the world. So that was really like the genesis of the thing. It was an interesting discussion with my wife, tough negotiation, but she agreed. And so got going.
That's great. You know, for our audience's benefit, you know, I presume there's everyone shares this image of a factory of just being a mess and, you know, chaotic. But then at the same time, yes, I mean, we've either seen or heard stories of Starlink's factories or Tesla's factories churning out, you know, dishes or batteries respectively. To your point, very well oiled, thought out factories. What percentage are like Elon's factories? And you know, it's like, is the rest of the world just playing catch up?
So OSS was created 4.5 years ago, and we physically visited 860 factories. I probably visited 200 myself. We have that big database where we put everything. And according to the database, about 5% of factories are what we call doer visionaries, where you walk the shop floor and it's virtually a tech company. Coders around, data, AI doing the job and everything. 5%. 20% of factories are what we call getting there. And getting there is like people want to do it, but it's still a mess. So they're like, we want tech, we want AI, we want it to run good. And they're in the process of doing it. They're getting there, but it's not yet done. And then you have like 40% of, maybe they'll make it, maybe not. And 35%, it's an absolute like freak show. And like, I would not want my daughter to go and work there. And so basically our mission is to get the doer visionary from 5 to like 50% of US and Europe factory in like 10 years. That's the thing. And actually, when you work at those factories, imagine being inside the computer. So the machines work together, but there's nobody like operating them. And like they are coders and they code the machines, they code the rules of the machines and everything. And they are fun. And the factory is cool and pristine and it's automated. And you can make literally millions per day because when you do a factory and you churn out like some tens of thousands of starting per day, and the margin on those is 50%, it's a money maker. And so, yeah, it's fun to be in those companies.
Yeah, the world is changing, and you know, as I'm listening to you, you can, you know, it's really exciting, because you can just imagine, you know, a world that becomes extremely efficient, not only with materials, with energy, but just from a, you know, bottom line perspective as a consequence. I have a bunch more questions I'd like to ask before we do, if we can take a step back. I'd love to know more about your career, the exit that you have, and you know, what it looked like leading up to OSS.
Sure. So, I grew up in an army family. So, I think we moved like 15 times before I was 18 in 15 different cities, but also in like 10 different countries. So, I lived in Africa, but like moving every 9 months to 1 year. I was better with computers than with people. Let's put it that way. And so, I was good at math. So, I did engineering studies. And I did it in France because I said, hey, I'm going to settle in France to do my studies because I can't move around everywhere. And I went to like one of the top schools of engineering in France. And I learned that they were paying you, like the school would pay you during your studies, which is awesome if you ask me. Like it's very reverse from the US where you have to pay. But at the end, you need to either be a public servant for 2 years, or you have to pay back. And paying back with other siblings on a one income household was not an option. So I became a public servant, an economist for OECD, like the big international thing. The only reason I did that was because it is the highest paid civil servant in France. So I just Googled highest paid civil servants. I did that for 2 years in one day, literally. And I just wanted to go into operations. I don't know why. I was fascinated with factories and everything. So I found first a consulting company called McKinsey, did that for like 4 years. And then I got to be a factory director, a supply chain director, defense, aerospace, and I ended up in luxury in Switzerland. And I did that for like 8 years. Loved it. If you're a nerd, organizing a factory is just so gratifying. I mean, you know, there are those games now, like Factorio and everything, where you literally build a factory. And like a lot of engineer type are playing those games. So I did that for 10 years. And I said, hey, I like it, but I'm always out energizing my bosses. And my boss always tell me, yeah, you're doing great, but tone down with the projects and everything, like, ah, it's on your job. And I was like, no. And so I understood that I was an entrepreneur, but I understood it at like 27 because nobody in my family was an entrepreneur. Like I had no idea. And also at the time in Europe, it was frowned upon. Like it is not like in the US where entrepreneurship is really cool and trendy. Like it was like you're entrepreneur, like you need to find a normal job. And so becoming an entrepreneur when you have a normal, very well-paying job is like, that is like. So I became an entrepreneur and I created a tech company and I leverage AI to hire people who are bottom of the social ladder and hire them based on their skills rather than their previous experiences. So it leverage AI, it leverage a lot of things, but basically, if you love talking to people and you like to multitask, you're probably going to be very happy in a hotel. But if you are introvert, but you're really good with like being detail-oriented and you like to not talk with people, you're probably going to be happy in a warehouse. And it's as simple as discovering that and routing people to the right job, and then they are more effective. So at one point, we were doing one job offer out of every 80 job offer in Brazil. So yeah, we based the company in San Francisco, went from like three founders to like 100 employees in like 1 year and a half. Went to significant revenue. We did seed series A, series B in like 2 years. And then I exited my shares. So half in cash and the other half I still hold the shares. and a happy shareholder of that company. And so I found myself at like 30 something in San Francisco, exited, not knowing what to do. And then I visited Tesla Fremont. So that's a story.
Wow, that's super exciting. And it totally makes sense that you've had success with this company of matching people with the positions. Have you had analogies like that before? That if you're gonna hire, you know, a receptionist, hopes that they're an extrovert and enjoy talking with people.
Exactly. And you would like, especially at the bottom of the social ladder, where nobody took that much care into, okay, what are you good at? What do you like? Yeah. And hence, what position will you be successful in? Like, very few people care at the bottom of the social ladder. And so if you put tech and you do it right, like the numbers were, for one client, Grupo Poder de Açúcar, which is like the Walmart of Brazil. We divided turnover at the 6 months mark by two, like a factor of two.
Wow.
Like they would have like 40% of people quitting after 6 months. And with us, it was less than 20. But
wow.
It's just because you make sure that people's true preferences are respected. That's simple as that.
Well, I mean, how do you argue it's not a win-win? You know, you give someone meaningful work, they enjoy it. And then, you know, employers are happy because they retain staff and they don't incur the cost to have to deal with turnover.
Exactly.
No, it makes good sense. Okay, so back to OSS. You know, it's interesting. You know, I don't know that manufacturing has a negative stigma in the US per se. Rather, you just don't hear a lot of Americans talking about it. And I'm sure if we unpacked it, it's, you know, probably because we have exported a lot of manufacturing jobs outside of the country over the decades. But there is a resurgence to bring manufacturing nearshore, onshore. Have you find that you're still having to convince people the value of creating a AI-driven manufacturing factory? Or do you feel like, no, there actually has been a sea change and there's the interest has grown?
So one of the most transformational thing that happened at OSS was like 3 years ago, where a guy named Philippe, incredible factory director, he passed away sadly last year. And I was telling him, look, there's that top 5% factories. They are doing great. Look at the numbers. Look at all the thing. And I'm like, I'm on the road every single day with the founders and we need to convince people. And it's like, it's too hard. It takes too much time because we have to build, but we have to convince them. And he just told me, hey, what is the percentage of people who are already convinced? I was like, maybe 15%. And he said, hey, that's a multi-trillion dollar market. Go and find those and only talk to those. And that was transformational. And so we totally pivoted our way of working with the founders. And so basically we make a lot of calls, but then we have a set of questions like, do you honestly think that we can move the EBITDA of your company thanks to technology? Yes, no. Are you willing to put a meaningful budget while it works? Are you willing to scale this thing to your 15 factories in the world in less than 1 year when it works? And it's okay if you don't believe it. It's okay. Like, I'm not here to convince you. I'm here to make it work. And so I work with people who want to make it work. And so that was a long answer, but the short answer would be 15-20% of people. And that's enough. That's enough. You know, like 40 years ago, majority of factories were not mechanized with machines that were programmable with computers. And only 20% of people were believers They got and then took the markets, and the other ones are either dead or got bought out, and that's okay.
You paint a very compelling picture, and it's interesting. So let's talk about AI. The world is obviously changing. Artificial intelligence topic du jour. I think it's very difficult to argue that it's not a new industrial revolution. As part of that, I personally have opinions that their successful investments are going to have the successful AI investments will have specific characteristics, and they include data collection, unique networking effects, very unique IP that is difficult to copy, or hardware. And in that, and by consequence, the analogy I like to use is, like, if I think of Adobe trying to bring Photoshop to market today, they would have a very difficult time.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have people who can code Photoshop. I mean, obviously we're not the same maturity, but effectively a similar program within a weekend. So it's like, okay, the world has changed. How do you compete? And so I'm curious, do you share that outlook, or was it just, a natural progression that led you to this point to give you the success that you're seeing today?
So I actually think I'm a very lucky individual, like on a general basis. And we are working with factories, and factories went through the Industrial Revolution. So we have a few stories to tell. If you look at the typical factory now, it's like 150 people. They are operating the equivalent of the output that would be a 1,500 people factory before mechanization. So if you walk to an accounting office with 1,500 people, you see exactly the same characteristic as pre-machines factories. So a lot of things are done a lot of time. The control point is very low, meaning that people are not busy tweaking the rules and doing problem solving. They are busy doing the thing.
Right.
In a factory, nobody is busy hammering away a thing. They are looking at the data stream of the machines hammering the thing. And if there is an issue or a way to make it better, their control point is higher. And so in the grand scheme of things, I just think that AI is going to do to white collar, like repetitive intellectual work, what machines did to physical work, which is we'll go 10x less number of jobs, 2x the output, and people are going to be in control of the rule set and the problem solving, but not of doing the thing. So the control point will be higher. And so if you project yourself to that world, and so the thesis that I'm not buying, and we are seeing it with our companies in the portfolio, we are not buying the AI will replace everything and there will be no one. Like, you need people to be in control of the rules and the problem solving, because systems always get in the way. Like, any mechanic will tell you so, that any car at some point needs repairs. And so what we are seeing with AI, if you project yourself to that thing, is, for example, supply chain. The supply chain of, do you know Shein, like the Chinese company? They are, okay, the supply chain department of Shein is 40 data scientists, and they are running an 8 billion sales operation with like thousands of factories in the way, because the control point is on the rules and not on the system. And so this points at the future of what will be. And so to us, the successful AI founders in that era will be able to create the ecosystem that puts people of control in the rules, that orchestrate the system. And we agree with you, very verticalized and very fit for purpose for one job, like supply chain, quality control, product design, mechanical engineering. And so Let me give you another example. If you go to General Electric today, and you ask a very simple question, hey, Mister from industrialization, when you code a machine, how much time does it take to you, and how many machines are running the code? The answer will be probably like, it takes me 1 week, and then two machines are running the code because I'm in charge of that local factory. If you go to BYD, you ask the same question, and they will say, it takes me 1 week, but when I push enter, the code gets to 10 factories and 200 mm-hmm. machines. And so the leverage of one individual is like literally 20 times higher. So yeah, that's the world we are getting to with varying speed, but it's coming anyway.
Yeah, so as I listen to you, I just think productivity goes through the roof.
Oh yeah.
The amount of wealth creation that takes place is astronomical. I agree with your assessment that it's a reorganization of human capital versus the displacement. And like every new industry, you're going to have new ones that pop up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like 100 years ago, we are all busy in a farm or in a factory with an output that was like five times less than what we have today. And so I would be very happy for my daughter to live in a world where like 30% of people are like researchers, and we get to Mars. Like, it would be a cool world.
So when I hear you say 30% of research, people who are doing research, my thoughts immediately go to robotics.
Yeah.
So how do you, when you're looking at that founder with the Gmail account, you know, or just more broadly, how do you think about robotics in the world?
So we think that robotics will 100x in the next like 20 years. Mm-hmm. Two reasons for that. One, the cost of automating one task is going down 10x.
Yeah.
Because AI can generate the code, but also because you even have like real-time code generation, context dependence, where robots can now understand the world that they are in. And so you can give them tasks like pick the box, and they will pick the box and understand how to pick the box real-time and everything. So that's one. And two, probably robotics is going to get out of the warehouse and the factory. And mm-hmm. so we should see that in like service industry. Japan is extremely big on robotics for elder care because we literally don't have enough people to care for elders. So all those things. So we have that thesis. What is very unclear to us is it vertical by vertical? Or is there going to be like a foundational model that gets most of the value, and you have actually one type of robot and they basically replace a lot of the human labor for physical tasks? That is very clear to us. So we don't know, like if you urge me to bet on the structure of the value creation in robotics 10 years from now, is it like four companies being the new Magnificent Seven? Or is it four companies doing 20% of the value creation and like a zillion companies? I don't know. I don't know. But yeah, all technical things are there to make it happen.
It's a fun question. If I had it, I would say in the beginning, it starts with four. And then presuming that they sell or lease their robots to other companies, then people start using those robots, you know, to specific sub-segments of the market, and then it picks up.
You know, when really, like, so I'm a nerd about economic history and those kind of things. If you look at machines in factories, you had basically 20 companies taking 90% of the value creation and mechanizing everything. And then in the factories, the number of companies went down by a factor of 5x in 30 years because the intensity of capital needed to put the machines was so high that people were not having access to capital enough to do the thing. And so small companies died out because they were not competitive or got bought out. And so if you say, okay, same thing is going to happen in robotics and maybe in verticals that are, yes, manufacturing and warehousing, but also other verticals, like, can your local mom and pop shop survive if they cannot afford or implement a human robot? Or everyone can implement a human robot, so mom and pop shops are going to thrive because now it makes less sense to be a Starbucks, basically.
Only because I tend to be an optimist. I think the means of production become available to everybody. And people also, robots start building other robots.
That would be my bet too, honestly. But that's a fun thing to think about.
Oh, so much fun. I mean, I don't know that there's ever been a more exciting time to be alive.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, if I, you know, if I put my investment, my pure investment analyst hat on, I think when this is all said and done, it looks great on the other side. There may be a tiny ravine, you know, between short-term gyrations as human capital gets reorganized. But I think ultimately on the other end, you end up with a whole bunch of researchers who can figure out how we can go explore the galaxy. Because you now can free people up from doing lower productivity tasks than robots.
Yeah, of course. I think on a long enough time frame, the only thing that matters is adoption of technology. On a short time frame, there may be like some seriously bad times, but on a long enough time frame, adoption of technology is equal to GDP growth.
I agree, and I'll remain optimistic that everyone gets lifted.
Yeah, exactly.
It works out. Renan, I really enjoyed the podcast. Before we wrap up, one of the questions I enjoy asking our guests is a retrospective. And so if you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
So first I would say buy Bitcoin. That's easy. Not grandiose, but very effective.
That's awesome.
I would say to try to make things happen faster and also be more patient at the same time, if it makes sense. I think I've always struggled with not being patient, like at all, and being extremely frustrated because in my mind, things should move way more quickly. And so I would say, like, keep the sense of urgency, but try to ditch the frustration, if it makes sense.
Yeah.
That would be one. Second is, I would tell myself to become an entrepreneur way sooner and to go to the US way sooner.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yeah. Like, I sometimes wonder what would be the version of myself if I had gone to the US like at 20 years old and launched a company right away. But yeah, I got there and I'm really grateful for what it brought me. So yeah, so that would be a second. And maybe a third, I would tell myself to look closely at what's happening in technology, in factories, maybe like 2 years sooner, because we're having so much fun that I wish we started sooner.
Okay. And I have an idea, but I don't want to assume. Why come to the US sooner?
So, believe it or not, I had to go to the US because the business that I was doing was illegal in Europe because of like GDPR and personal data and everything. And so I literally had to move out for the business model. And I discovered the American way of doing things, which I fell in love with at that time.
Got it. You know, I would hope that everyone has an opportunity to travel the world. You know, but, you know, I think one of the key takeaways is that every culture is unique.
It is.
And I've consistently heard an affinity for U.S. Cultures, especially as it comes to business. I don't know about quality of life, because I think I'd rather be with you eating cheese and baguettes
Yeah.
this weekend. Instead of working all the time. But I totally understand. Point well taken. Brendan, last question before we wrap up. Anyone in your personal or professional career you'd love to recognize for having a meaningful impact on you over the years?
I would say three, two of which I will only tell the name, the surname. So the first is called Jean-Pierre. And Jean-Pierre was the first operational guy, like C-level, C-suit, that got me under his wing and told me the ropes of being a factory director. And it was transformational to me. Like, I really fell in love with operations thanks to Jean-Pierre. The guy was like 60-ish. He was not an engineer. He went through the ranks and he was managing like 500 people in a factory that is one of the most complex factories I've ever lived in, which is like it's a luxury watch factory. So like thousands of components for each watch. Like it's just hard to operate. And that guy was a genius and he was so respectful of people. And like it's like watching like an NBA star play. You just watch in awe and you say, I want to be that guy. And it seems simple on TV, but then when you become the factory director, it's not that simple. So Jean-Pierre, that would be the first. The second would actually be Philippe. So Philippe was like, he was a top executive at like 32 of a Fortune 500 corporation. That's how smart Philippe was. And I got to meet the guy when he was like 64. He was retired. And when I told him I want to do OSS and everything, he said, that's awesome. I'm going to help you. And he made the introductions for like half of the people that we ended up working with industrial side in the first year, just because he believed in the mission. And so like when I grow old, I really want to be like Philippe and able to be transformational for young people like us. And like he was so visionary, like he was more visionary than most young people. And so that's amazing. The third would be, it's actually one of the founders of my portfolio companies. The name is Luc Leroy. He lives in San Francisco. He was the guy who got Tesla out of the automation hell.
Oh.
And so he's a former Tesla engineer. He was like an indirect report to Elon, which is like a full-time job. And like we spent so much time discussing about how factories should work, going from first principles. Like it feels like we are in the early days of like Cisco or IBM disputing, like having discussions about computation and servers. And we are literally building the future of, okay, in 10 years, probably every factory is going to run like this. And a lot of people thought that we were crazy, but at the end it works. And so, and Luc, just to give you an idea of who the guy is, he created a company called Vitesse Full Speed Automation. He can code any machine with natural language real time. And yeah, he's an awesome human being, and he really sometimes being an innovator is hard because like literally 80% of people think that you're going to fail. And there are some people who have a large set of incentives for you to fail, like legacy people selling things to factories and everything, they hate us. So it's good to have allies.
Well, shout out to Jean-Pierre, Philippe, and Luc. Awesome. Thank you for sharing. Renan, I genuinely appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your perspective with our audience. If there's anyone who would like to get a hold of you or learn more about OSS Ventures, how can they find you?
So LinkedIn, we have a website, oss.ventures. We are very simple people. I also like live in the US about a third of my time, Boston area, but I'm always around visiting factories and everything. So if you are a founder, if you want to become a founder, you don't have an idea. If you are a factory director, a manufacturing executive, and you say, hey, that seems interesting, like we live on the road in the factories with the founders trying to make it happen. So please come down, come our way.
Fantastic. And again, Brennan, thank you so much. Genuinely appreciate your time. Thank you. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Brennan Dedeir, founder and CEO of OSS Ventures.
Thank you so much, Christian.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrap Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.